Luerden and I descended a staircase beyond the sun image. We went first to the treasure vault. While Luerden gloated over the stacks of golden fingers, I watched his face. I was light-headed from lack of sleep, and I could taste the spirits I had drunk in the back of my throat. Watching Luerden, I tried to find hatred for him in my heart. I searched diligently without success. When he looked up at me and smiled, I could not but answer him with a smile. "This will keep, Ben," he said. "Let's go and have a look at the rest of it." I had guessed what we would find beyond the junction of the tunnels, and once we'd descended the last spiraling stairs and come into another short level, I had my last doubts dispelled. The passage ended against another solid stone wall. Here, however, there was no attempt at concealment, for carved into the stone was an inscription. We stood before it, and Luerden held the arc lamp full upon it. "What does it say?" he asked. I read it through slowly. Even with all my practice, I read slowly, for in Punic there are no symbols for the vowels, and each must be guessed from the context of the word. "Come on," Luerden muttered impatiently. "Ye who come here to interrupt the sleep of the kings of Opet and to despoil their tomb, do so at your peril. And may the curse of Astarte and great Baal hound you to your own graves." "Read it again," Luerden commanded, and I did. He nodded. "Yes," he said, and stepped to the stone door. He began to seek the pivot point, which we knew would trigger the mechanism. Here we were not so fortunate as we had been at the threshold of the sun door. After 2 hours, our way was still barred by that solid slab of uncompromising stone. "I'm going to blow the bloody thing open," Luerden warned. But I knew he would not commit such an atrocity in this sacred place. We rested and discussed the problem before returning to the door. It had to be another simple leverage system. But the trick was to find the pressure point and the angle of movement. When we found it at last, I cursed my own stupidity. It should have been my first attempt. The symbol for the name of the sun god Baal was once more the pressure point. The door swung open, ponderous and slow, and we went through into the tomb of the kings of Opet. There is only one other place I've known with the same atmosphere. That is Westminster Abbey, which contains the tombs of so many of the kings of England. There was the same hushed cathedral sense of time past and history reborn. Neither of us spoke as we went to the center of the long, narrow, vaulted tomb. The silence was an oppressive weight upon my eardrums, utter silence, so complete as to be sinister and threatening. Here again the air was long disused, but with an even heavier, musty quality to it. I thought I detected the faint, stale smell of dust and mushrooms. Along each wall, parallel to it, stood the sarcophagi of the kings of Opet. They were carved of massive granite, solid, squat, and grey. The lids were held in place by their own immense weight, and the upper surface had been polished and engraved with the name and style of the body that lay within. The mighty names that had echoed through the golden books of Hui. I recognized them. Hamilcar, Hannibal, Hyrcanus, 47 great coffins. But the last was empty, its lid propped against the wall beside it. Its interior cut out into a man's shape, ready to swallow the last king of Opet. At the foot of the great stone coffin, a man lay stretched upon his back on the floor of the tomb. His helmet was missing, and his red-gold hair and beard formed a soft frame for the wizened, mummified features. His breastplate had been removed, exposing the dried parchment skin stretched over the gaunt skeletal ribcage. The broken shaft of an arrow protruded from a long, dead chest. He wore a kilt of leather studded with bronze rosettes, and on his shins were greaves of bronze, on his feet light sandals. His arms lay at his side, his heels were together. The dead body had been laid out with care and obvious love. Over him stooped another figure, kneeling like a man in prayer. A figure in full armour, with only the war helmet and breastplate discarded on the floor beneath the empty sarcophagus. Long black hair hung forward to conceal his bowed head. Both hands clutched at his chest at the level of the diaphragm. From his chest, a blade of steel protruded, a reversed sword, with its hilt securely anchored against the stone slabs of the floor, the point driven up under the ribs and lodged in his vitals. Here was a man in the attitude of final escape from the shame of defeat, a man who in despair had fallen upon his own sword. The weapon had supported his weight these many centuries, propping him up in that kneeling position. Neither Lurin nor I could speak as we drew closer to this tableau of ancient tragedy. For me there was no doubt as to the identity of these dried-out human husks. Lannon Hyrcanus, the last king of Opet, lay stretched on the cold stone floor, and above him knelt his friend and high priest, Hui Ben Ammon. I felt choked with a sense of destiny, with a cold, aching dread. For he, Ben Ammon, the axeman of the gods, was a hunchback. I had to see his face. I had to see it. I ran forward and knelt beside him. I touched his gaunt, bony shoulder covered by a tunic of brittle yellow linen. It was the lightest touch, a breath almost, but it was enough to shatter that delicately poised mummy. The corpse of Hui Ben Ammon slid forward and crashed down on the body of the king. Steel and bronze rang on the stone floor and echoed about the vaulted tomb of Opet. The two figures burst into dust at the impact. A soft yellow explosion of mustard-yellow dust swirling like smoke in the arc light. There was nothing left of them but the metal of armour and sword and two hanks of gold and sable hair in the puddle of talcum-soft dust. I stood up, choking with the yellow dust. My eyes were swimming with tears of wonder and burning with the dust. The dust smelt of mushrooms. Lauren Stervescent and I stared at each other without speaking. We had witnessed a miracle. I awoke from a screaming nightmare of blood and flame and smoke, a horror of shining black faces and sweat-polished bodies lit by crackling, roaring flames, and the scream of the dying and the animal roar of blood-crazed voices. I woke panting and choking from the memory, and the terror and horror of it stayed with me long after I'd find myself alone in my quiet hut in the silent night. I switched on the bedside light and looked at my watch. It was still early, a little before 11. I threw back my sheets and stood up, surprised to find my legs shaky and my breathing ragged. There was a twinge of pain at each breath I drew, and a dull, tight sensation behind my eyes. My body felt hot, fever hot. I went to the washstand across the hut and shook 3 aspirin from the bottle. I swallowed them with a mouthful of water, and then the tickling sensation in my lungs grew stronger. I coughed as though I was on 60 cigarettes a day, and the effort left me sweaty and trembling. My skin seemed to be aflame. Without really knowing why, I took my dressing gown off the hook behind the door, pulled it on, and went out into the yard. There was a half moon in the sky, horned and yellow. The shadows under the trees and around the buildings were very dark and ugly. I felt the lingering dread and horror of my nightmare still upon me as I hurried towards my office, and I glanced about me nervously. I could smell the tinge of smoke on the night air, and it troubled me also. I sniffed at it, feeling the faint sting deep in my lungs. I reached the door of my office, and there was something waiting for me in the deep shadow beside the building. I saw it rush at me from the corner of my vision. A big, dark thing, rounded, shapeless, and deadly quiet. I spun to face it, falling against the wall of the hut, weak with terror. A scream bubbled and died in my throat, for there was nothing there. It was gone. I'd imagined it. But now the pain in my head beat like hammer blows on the anvil. I pulled the door open, fell into my office, slammed the door behind me, locked it, gasping with unnamed and baseless fear. Something scratched against the door from the outside, a terrifying, clawing animal sound that ripped my quivering nerves. I backed away from the door towards my desk, crouching there, trembling, shaking, and weak. The sound came again, but from the wall beside me. I spun to face it, and I heard myself whimper. I needed a weapon. I looked around desperately, and the great battle axe of Hui hung on the wall above my desk. I snatched it down and backed into a corner, holding it ready at the present position across my chest. I coughed. There was a thick sheaf of white paper on my desk. It moved, and I felt the goose flesh crawl all over my hot body. The white square of paper quivered and wavered, changed shape, crawled across my desk, and spread white bat's wings. And then suddenly it launched into flight, wings whispering, and it flew at my face. I saw the wide-open mouth ringed with needle vampire teeth, heard the shrill squeaks as it attacked. I shouted with horror and struck with the axe. The white thing fluttered and squeaked against my throat and face, and I fought and shouted, striking it down onto the floor, where it crawled and slithered loathsomely. I struck with the edge of the axe, and inky black blood spurted from the thing and puddled the wooden floor of the hut. I backed away from the thing and lay back against the wall. I felt weak and terribly afraid. I began to cough. The cough took hold of my whole body and shook it, rocking me, doubling me against the wall. I coughed until my vision burst into bright lights, and there was a salty, sweet taste in my mouth. I sank to my knees against the wall. My mouth was filled with warm wetness, and I spat a thick gob of bright blood onto the floor. I stared at it, not understanding what was happening to me. I lifted my hand to my mouth and wiped my lips. My hand came away smeared with blood. I knew then what it was. Lorin and I had passed beyond two sealed doorways into the depths of a tomb closed for 2,000 years, and we had breathed air loaded with the spores of Cryptococcus neuromyces, the curse of the pharaohs. It was too late now for me to berate myself for overlooking the precautions. I had believed that because the archives were safe, the rest of it was also. In my eagerness and excitement, I'd not given another thought to the fungus danger, even when Lurin and I had discussed the door seals, and even when I'd smelt the mushroom odor in the Tomb of the Kings. Now my lungs were clogged with the horrible colonies of living fungus, a growing living thing within me, feeding on the soft tissues of my body and pouring out its poisons into my blood to be carried to my brain. "Treatment," I gasped. "Got to find the treatment." And I staggered across to my bookshelves. I tried to read the letters on the spines of the books, but they changed to little black insects and crawled away. Suddenly, a thick, mottled snake uncoiled from the top shelf and dangled down towards my face, a thick, bloated puff adder with a flicking black tongue. I backed away and then turned and fled out into the night. The smoke was thick, swirling around me, choking me so that I coughed wildly. The flames around me lit all with a lurid, satanic glow, a flickering glow. There were dark shapes and strange sounds. I saw Lorin's hut and ran towards it. Lorin! I screamed, bursting in through the door. Lorin! I was panting and coughing. The light went on. Sally was alone in Lorin's bed. She sat up, sleepy, soft-eyed, naked, and looked at me with unfocused vision. Where is he? I shouted at her. She looked confused, not understanding. Ben, what is it? You're bleeding. Where is Lo? It was desperately urgent. I had to find him. He had been exposed to the fungus also. I had to find him. Sally looked down at the bed beside her. There was the indentation on the pillow where Lorin's head had lain. I don't know, she said, big-eyed and puzzled. He was here. He must have gone out. I coughed great choking sobs and felt fresh blood in my mouth. Sally was fully awake now, and she stared at me. Ben, what is it? Neuromyces, I told her. And she gasped, seeing the blood streaming down my chin. Lorin and I opened a secret passage beyond the sun image in the archives. It's infected with the spores. We took no precautions. It's got us. I'm sure he's there now. I'm going to him. I stopped to breathe. Sally was out of bed, slipping into her gown, coming to me. Get Ral Davidson. Respirators. Take all precautions. Follow us. I'll prop the doors open. Down steps, turn left at bottom. Follow us. Lorin will have it also. It drives you mad. Crazy. Terrible things. And come quickly, do you understand? Yes, Ben. Get Ral, I said, and turned. I ran out into the smoke and flames and darkness, running for the cliffs and the cavern. The great walls of the temple towered above me, walls long gone. The great phallic towers of Baal pointed to the moon, lit by the flames of a burning city. Towers that stood again after so long. They were screaming, the women, burning alive with their children. Dead men lay strewn in my path, cut down like the harvest of the devil, their dead faces terrible in the moonlight. Lorin! I shouted and ran on through the temple. They were in my path, dark, savage, crowding forward to oppose me. Dark, shapeless, terrifying. And I flew at them with a strange battle cry, yelled from a blood-glutted throat. The mighty axe spun its silver circles in the firelight, and I was through them, running. I reached the cavern, saw it lit by the guttering torches, saw the pavement of stone bordering the circular green beauty of the emerald pool. The rows of stone benches rising in tiers around it, as they had 2,000 years before. With a last enormous effort of will, I forced my brain to discount this fantasy and to recognize reality. The wooden guard hut stood across the cavern from me. I staggered towards it. The guard sat at his desk reading. He looked up, his expression changing to surprise and incredulity. Good God, are you all right, Doctor? Mr. Stuyvesant, is he in the tunnel? Yeah. When did he go in? An hour ago. The guard came towards me. Is something wrong? You're bleeding, Doctor. Wait here, I told him. The others are coming. They know what to do. I hurried on into the archives, smelling the smoke still and hearing the clamour of a dying city ring in my ears. Before the image of the sun god, I let the great battle axe slip from my hand and left it lying on the stone floor. I pushed the stone door open and propped it with one of the war shields to prevent it swinging closed behind me. I ran on down the staircase. Halfway down, I saw the glow of light from the tomb below. The inscribed doorway with its graven curse of the gods stood open, jammed in the hinge by the cable of the arc light. The light lay on its side in the center of the tomb where Lorin had dropped it. The bulb still burnt, lighting the tomb vividly. Lorin lay on his back at the foot of the huge granite sarcophagus of Lannan Hyrcanus, the last king of Opet. He was naked to the waist, his face was deathly pale, his eyes closed, and bright blood stained the corners of his mouth and ran back down his cheeks into his ears and hair. With the last of my strength, I staggered to where he lay and dropped onto my knees beside him. I stooped over him and tried to lift him, my arms around his shoulders. His skin was moist and burning hot, and his head flopped helplessly backwards. A new, bright gush of blood ran out of his mouth, wetting my hands. "Lorin, Lorin," I cried, holding him to my chest. "Oh, please, God, help me, help me." There was still life in him, just the last flicker of it. He opened his eyes, those pale blue eyes with the first shadows of death darkening them.
"Ben, Ben," he whispered, choking with his own blood.
He coughed, spattering droplets of the bright lung blood.
"Ben,"
and he whispered so softly I could hardly hear it.
"All the way."
"All the way, Lo," I whispered, holding him like a sleepy child. His head of golden curls was cradled against my shoulder. He was quiet for a little while, and then suddenly he stirred again. And when he spoke, it was in a clear, strong voice. "Fly," he said. "Fly for me, bird of the sun." And the life went out of him. He turned to nothing in my arms. The great wild spirit flown, gone. I knelt over him, feeling my own senses reel. The world turned and swung beneath me. I slipped over the edge of it, down into the swirling darkness of time, down into a kind of death, a kind of life, for in my dying I dreamed a dream, in my poisoned sleep of death, which lasted a moment and a million years. I dreamed of long dead men in time long past.